hunting bears with dogs had been outlawed in Washington State. So the bear hunters were really excited because this was their one legal avenue to be able to hunt bears with dogs. Turns out this was a permitted process. And so when we went to get all of the permits, we discovered that, in fact, the people who were giving the stamp of approval for the hunts was not the state, but they had just given that over to the timber companies to approve every single one of them. Not one permit that had been applied for had ever been rejected, even though they were supposed to be looking at regulations to do that. So that's an example of, you know, who would have thought that kind of thing would be regulated, but it was, and in a way that made for interesting news. So that's just, you know, any time you can find the paper or the documents related with something or the databases behind it, it can be really useful. When you're trying to get the data, spreadsheets are your friend. Just learn a spreadsheet and you'll be about 100 times more advanced than you were before. You can do a lot with spreadsheets. Sometimes the data comes in a paper form that you need to scan in, or in PDFs. I don't know if you've noticed this, but governments really like PDFs. They really like to give you information in PDFs. Sometimes that means that you can, you know, it just makes it more difficult. But there are a couple of tools, Tabula and Comet Docs, that allow you to get data out of PDFs. So if it is a image scan. So sometimes if you open a PDF, if you click on it and you see a cursor, then it's going to be much easier and you can use Comet Docs, which allows 5 free basically conversions, I think, a month. Or you can get the pro version. If you're a member of IRE, you can get the pro version for free. And you can just upload the entire PDF, and if it's kind of structured columns and rows, that kind of thing, it will convert it into an Excel spreadsheet. If you have a PDF that's like a big report with a lot of narrative text, and then trapped in the middle of it is this little tiny spreadsheet kind of thing with rows and columns, Tabula is excellent, and it is free. It is open source. If you go Google it, it's like the first result. It's also tabula.technology if you want to just go straight to the URL. And what you do is you download it, and then it runs in your browser but locally on your machine. So you just upload your PDF into the Tabula software, and then you just drag around the thing that you want and convert it, and you can then download it and open it up in a spreadsheet. And I've used it for so many things I can't even tell you. But so for Tabula, you can't use that if it's just an image. Comet Docs will process it to make it so it's clickable. If it's just an image, Tabula will not work. So that's an important thing to know about. Trifacta Wrangler and OpenRefine are two tools that you can use. And I'm just, in the interest of time, I'm not going to each one of these. But basically, these are tools that you use to clean up messy data. So let's say that the name is misspelled 36 different ways. With OpenRefine, you can basically say, anything that, you know, all of these various spellings, I want to be this. And Trifacta does some other kinds of standardizations. There are great videos on how to use both of those tools, and they're really easy to learn. And so if you have messy data, don't hand clean it. Don't, like, hand change everything. Use these tools, and you'll save yourself hours and hours of time. The other thing I like to do when I'm looking at data is I like to explore my data visually. Sometimes that will end up becoming a presentation that we do online, and sometimes it won't. You know, it'll just be for my benefit of trying to just explore the data in a visual way. So for doing that, of course, you can use charts in a spreadsheet. You can also use Tableau Public. Okay, remind me what I do to click on the link again. Oh, look. There we go. Okay. No? Yep. Well, there we go. So this is just one example of a Tableau Public. This is a map that is zoomed in at the wrong level, but you get the idea that, so I could hover over any of these things and it will give me information. This has to do with algae in the water that a reporter did just this last year. So you can use Tableau Public to pull in data for you, like, you just import your spreadsheet, and then you can drag and drop, you can things onto basically rows and columns, but instead of it being rows and columns, it's like, oh, I want to look at it in a fever line chart or a bar chart or a pie chart or on a map. And then you can really kind of look for patterns, which I think is really important. And now I want to go back to my PowerPoint. There we go. Oh. Well, I thought I was back there. Okay. Thank you. Sorry. So Tableau Public is free. And that's an important thing to know. They have a paid version that's very expensive. If you're a member of IRE, that's also can be free. Really, if you just email them and say you're a journalist, they'll probably give you Tableau desktop for free. The benefits to having the paid version is that you can save it locally, which is really great. But I often will just throw my data into Tableau because I want to be able to see I just want to see what the patterns are and kind of explore it that way. So it's a pretty good tool. And again, there are a lot of kind of walkthroughs on how to do that, how to use the tool. It's not hard. You kind of have to wrap your mind around a different way of looking at it, but it's not any harder than learning a spreadsheet, I don't think. Then mapping, there is Esri Online and also Carto, which used to be CartoDB, and of course you can map in Tableau Public. Esri Online has a whole raft of tools and software, but you can also just do maps right there online. That's why it's called Esri Online. You can create like story maps and things for presentation, and you can do things that really help you just understand the patterns. So I'm going to mention just quickly, I did a project on prescription methadone that I was used to. I was not the reporter on it, but I was involved in the project. And we didn't realize that people who were using prescription methadone, we knew that there was a spike in fatal overdoses. We didn't realize that the spike in fatal overdoses corresponded to poor people until we mapped it over census tracts and looked at the median income of the census tracts. And we tossed that actually into a Google Fusion map, and all of a sudden the lead of the story changed because we mapped it. So we had a hunch, but we didn't really know for sure. So that it's really good to sometimes do that. So this is a story that we did. This is kind of what the nut graph was in like 2008. There was a huge flood. Interstate 5 between Portland and Seattle was closed for about a week. There were major rainstorms that barreled through. And what happened was, I'm going to go forward a minute, isn't that a great photo? So we actually, the photographer's name is Steve Ringman, and so we didn't know the name of the mountain. I don't know if it has a name, probably somewhere. So we just called that Mount Ringman because he took that picture hanging out of a helicopter, and side of a helicopter after this big, huge flood. So what happened was you see kind of those orange streaks that are going down the side of that mountain. Those are landslides that happened after the rainstorm, and those landslides clogged this creek. This ended up being our lead, Little Mill Creek. And, you know, it's great narrative detail. The reporters actually went out, you know, they were out there at that creek, and so they got great detail. But what happened was there was the rainstorm and the flood, and we started thinking, well, we saw that picture and we thought, I wonder if all that clear cut contributed to the fact that there were these landslides on that mountain. And so we started calling and say, are there permits for when you have to do clear cuts? And lo and behold, there were permits for when you had to do clear cuts. They were all on paper. There were something like 300 or 400 of them, I think. And let's see. Yeah, let's see. How many did I say there were? Well, anyway, I think there were 300 or 400 permits. And we looked at all of them. And then we used a variety of analyses. We partnered with the University of Washington and some folks who specialized in that, and really overlaid, like, was the slope stable? Was it not stable? There are all these reports that go with the permits where the timber company is supposed to say the slope is stable, and the state is not supposed to let them log if the slope is unstable or too steep. And just like with the bear example that I used earlier, the state had pretty much just approved everything, and the timber companies were using reports saying that slopes were stable when all of the documentation clearly showed that the slopes were not stable. And so what we found was that there were a lot more landslides, essentially, on the slopes that had been logged. And so, which may not be surprising, but the sheer scope of it was pretty interesting. The state started to increase the regulation after this story, or at least they said they were going to. This was like 2008, 2009. But sadly, there was more talk than action. And then in 2014, we had the Oso landslide, where 43 people were killed after the side of a hill just completely obliterated this neighborhood. This was a map that we built using Esri. Those little gray kind of boundary lines are the boundary lines of properties. And the dots are the households. And then each one of those, we didn't want it to just be dots on a map, so we put linked all of those to the profiles of the victims. When we first published this, there were a lot of still unaccounted for. You can see there's the devastation. That's the neighborhood. Yeah. It's kind of stunning. That was horrible. And we wanted people to be able to see that and yet also see kind of the people related to that. And so that's what we tried to do with this map. When we started this project, what we did was we went out and got all the parcel data, so the property parcel data. We didn't know who the victims were, right? And we put all of that into a spreadsheet. And then we added, it's just going to kind of keep playing, but I think. But we put all of that into a Google sheet, and then we added things like voter registration information, any information we had about who the residents of those houses could be. And then we had the reporters go out and confirm with either emergency officials who had confirmed somebody lived in a house, or the family members. And then that's how we built this. But at first, we had a lot of we knew who the people were who were supposed to live in that house, but they were unaccounted for. And after we published this, one of those properties, the family was on vacation in Colorado, and they came to the Seattle Times, saw the map, saw that they were listed as unaccounted for, and called us. And then we put them in touch with the emergency responder folks so that they could get them down correctly, that they were alive and well and nobody was at that house. But since that was the kind of the breaking news piece, then we used that same data to really go back into time onto the permitting process. And again, it was that the state had allowed all kinds of things that they never should have allowed that development to be built, but they just completely ceded to all of the corporate interests. And now state law has really changed. So finally. But that's just another example, I guess. And I think I'm out of time.
Yeah, you are. And any of these things that you have questions on later, or you want to dig deeper into any of these tools, we can do that at the end if you have questions. But right now, I'd like to pass it on to Lisa. She needs the clicker.
Okay, cool. So let's see. Is this working? I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the data stories I've done. And I work at Inside Climate News, which is a pretty small newsroom. When I first started in 2011, there were five of us in the newsroom, and none of us had any data experience whatsoever. But the following year, my editor sent me to a week-long training session at IRE. And it was a week-long boot camp where they taught us the basics of how to use Microsoft Excel, and then how to use Microsoft Access, where you're using a programming language called SQL to do more advanced analysis. And after that week-long training, I was able to start doing real data stories. And this one, is the mic not working? Oh.
This one works, so like pass this on.
Yeah, that one's not working. All right. Okay. All right, is that, yes. Okay, so this was the first data story I did, and back then I was reporting a lot on the Keystone XL pipeline, and one of the things that the pipeline company kept saying was, we have these very advanced leak detection technology sensors on the pipeline so that if a spill ever happens, we'll detect it within minutes and then we'll shut down the pipeline and everything will be fine. So I decided to look into whether these sensors were actually reliable. And luckily, the federal government, the pipeline agency, which is called PHMSA, keeps a database of virtually every oil pipeline spill in the country. And you can just go to their website and download it. They update it about once a month. And so I downloaded that database for the previous 10 years worth of spills. And then I used Excel to pull out all of the oil pipeline spills because the original database contained things like ethanol and jet fuel and other things I wasn't interested in. And then once I had the oil spills, I then, one of the fields in the database tells you how the leak was initially detected, whether it was one of the sensors or, you know, someone who happened to be passing by seeing black stuff bubbling out of the ground. And then when I ran that analysis, I found that only 5% of the spills over 10 years had been detected by the sensors. So that told us a lot. And with this story, as with basically every data story, analyzing the data took not very long at all, probably just a few days of trial and error. But then I spent weeks interviewing pipeline experts and scientists and engineers to figure out how the technology works, why it's so unreliable, and to get the context. And I think that's true for almost every data story, is you spend a lot longer reporting than actually going through the nitty-gritty of the data. And this was a chart that I made from the data. We did not have a graphic designer back then, so this was just Excel. And one of the interesting things I found was when the leaks were very large, the sensors worked better. So for oil spills that were larger than 1,000 barrels, which is 42,000 gallons, the sensors worked more frequently. But even in those cases, it was easier for the general public to discover a spill than it was for their fancy technology. And one of the nice things about this story was I actually sent my SQL code to the federal government agency to have them fact check it and poke holes in it if they wanted to. And the spokesman there was really nice, and he sent it to some of the IT people in his department, and they, you know, suggested a few tiny tweaks, but nothing that changed the result. And so that made me very confident in my analysis, and I was able to, you know, actually share the results with the pipeline industry and say, this is what I found. I know it's correct because the government has confirmed it. Do you have a comment? And that made them much more willing to talk than if I just, you know, tried to get them to talk about leak detection in general. So I think this is something that works sometimes if you get the data from a government source and if they trust you and are willing to work with you, because it's also in their best interest for your analysis to be correct. So this is the next story I'm going to talk about, something I did 2 years ago. And this was a little more complicated because I had to create my own database. A colleague and I were looking into a consulting firm called Terra, which had been accused of being very industry friendly. And Terra's job was to put together peer review panels of scientists to look at various toxicity chemical studies. And they would review the existing literature on a chemical, and then, based on the results of their review, provide recommendations to the EPA and other agencies. And so when I went to the Terra website, I discovered that they had a PDF report of every single review they had done for the past 20 years. So I pulled all the PDFs, and then I made a big Excel chart of every single panel, the names of all the scientists that were chosen to serve on the panel, and then I color-coded them based on who they worked for, whether it was the industry, a consulting firm, government, academia, etc. And this took forever, but when I was done, I had some pretty solid numbers to show, and we did show, indeed, that Terra was very biased towards the industry. And, you know, it just turned out to be a couple of sentences in the story showing that they almost never selected any experts from environmental NGOs. They were very biased towards looking at studies that were funded by industry, And these were chemical companies that also funded Terra itself. So it was a very incestuous relationship. And then we also found that the president of Terra really liked to put himself on these panels, often as the chairman. And when we asked him about this, he said, you know, well, there just aren't that many qualified scientists out there. So he had a very high opinion of himself. And, he, you know, he himself had a history of working with the tobacco industry in the early 90s. So, you know, getting this kind of data, even though it was just a couple sentences in the story, was really worth it. And then the third story I'll show you is something I did recently, just a couple months ago. The World Health Organization had released an updated spreadsheet of particulate matter concentrations around the world. And these were annual average PM levels in various cities. And so I mapped the cities with the worst PM10 levels and the worst PM2.5 levels. And if you go to the link, you can, you know, it's an interactive map. You can zoom in and out. You can also hover your cursor over any of the dots, and it will show you the exact concentration, the name of the city, etc. One of the interesting things about this WHO data was when it was initially released in May, there was a burst of reporting about it, but there was very little mapping done, or if anyone mapped it, they mapped every single data point, which was just overwhelming. It was thousands and thousands of data points. And I wanted to do something a little different by only showing the worst cities. So, you know, I talked to the WHO and found the various thresholds they use for what's considered healthy, what's semi-healthy, what's considered really bad. And then I just mapped the really bad data points. And then the other thing about the database was there were a bunch of data points that aren't very reliable because of the poor quality of the sensors that were used. So I just got rid of all those data points. And in the end, I only mapped the reliable data points for the worst cities. And the data came from the WHO, but I only heard about it through Jeremy Singervine's weekly newsletter, which is called Data is Plural. It's a really fun newsletter. Jeremy's a reporter at BuzzFeed News, and he sends this out every week. He usually highlights about 6 or 7 databases on every subject, and usually about twice a month you'll get something that is energy or climate related. So I highly recommend it. For this analysis, I just used some basic sorting and filtering in Excel to get the initial data points. And then I put everything into Cardo, which Cheryl had pointed out earlier. The thing about Cardo is it will automatically geolocate all your data points for you. So it, you know, as long as you put in the city and country names, it will sense where the cities are and put them on the map. But I ran into some problems with the really obscure cities in China and India. Cardo got confused and put them in Australia. And a couple in France. So I had to go through manually and fact check some of those locations. So I think when you're using, you know, ready-made programs like Cardo that don't require a lot of technical knowledge, you just have to be really careful because the automated software, you know, might make mistakes. And finally, I'll talk about a couple of more complex projects I've done. This was a project that Inside Climate News did 2 years ago, where we collaborated with the Weather Channel and the Center for Public Integrity. And the really nice thing was CPI has really advanced data reporters, and I got to work with them and just sort of say, I want this, can you do it? And they would work their magic and things happened. So at one point we found that Texas has a database where whenever a citizen calls the state environmental agency and lodges a complaint, it would be recorded in this online database. And you can go online and look at all of the complaints individually, but that's not very helpful because I wanted to look at all of them and look at the trends. So we were looking at air pollution from oil and gas drilling in South Texas. So I asked the CPI reporters for help, and they were able to scrape the database, which means they pulled all of the complaints out at once over a 4-year period and put it on a spreadsheet for me. And then I was able to go through that. And then we created that chart, and our graphic designer put it on a map, highlighting some of the specific complaints. So scraping is something that you do with programming. I'm guessing the reporter used Ruby or Python or something like that. And it's more advanced stuff. But if you can partner with another newsroom or get a freelancer to do something like that, it can be really helpful. And then this is also from that same Texas project. We purchased oil and gas drilling data from the Texas regulators, and then we hired a freelancer to put them on this Google map. So every blue and black dot is an oil or gas well in a single county in Texas. And once we put it all up there, we were able to see how dense the drilling was. The other thing we did was we had interviewed several families for our story, and they were profiled extensively. And we put the homes of these people on the map and then drew like a circle around their home to see how much drilling they lived near. And for one family, there were more than 50 oil and gas wells within 2.5 miles of their house. And in addition to that, there were 9 processing plants. So, you know, having numbers like that really showed the scope of what these people were going through and why they were complaining. Again, this mapping was something more advanced, and we were really lucky to get this great freelancer to put it together for us. And finally, I'll just end with some resources. The first link goes to the curriculum and PowerPoint slides from ProPublica Summer Data Institute. That was something I did earlier this summer. It was a 2-week training where they taught us a little bit of everything. It was like Excel, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, Ruby, and a bunch of other things. It was basically an introduction to all kinds of data journalism with the idea that once you learn a little bit of it, you can then go on and learn the rest on your own. So that link goes to all of their teaching materials. The second link goes to Lena Greger's really long list of, again, online resources for teaching data journalism. And Lena is one of the ProPublica reporters who led the institute. And I think they're going to run the institute again next summer. So if you're interested, you should apply. And then the last link just goes to the IRE boot camps. They have various ones on Excel, statistics, mapping, and stuff. So that's it.
Hello. Can you, everybody hear me all right? So I'm going to talk about using satellites to tell stories. And this image is actually from Good Morning America earlier this week when some of my coworkers were on talking about a project that they had just launched. And we will get to that shortly. Satellites are basically a treasure trove for us, and it's largely untapped. We have decades worth of data, and that's continuously being updated and pretty much has global coverage. You can find a satellite image for anywhere in the world, and there are a ton of different things to do with it. We've been working with satellite data for about 2 years now, I would say. We've been kind of experimenting with it, playing around, seeing what kind of stories we could tell with it. This is our first stab. We developed some images to look at vegetation health, particularly in the California area due to drought. We wanted to see how the vegetation was doing throughout the course of the drought. And early last year, what happened is we noticed in this picture, if you look, the purple or blue that you see there is actually meant to show healthy vegetation, whereas the brown and the deep brown, that's drier than normal conditions. So in early last year, what we noticed is that the state was starting to look really green. And at first, we were a little worried because it meant we didn't have a story. But that greenness went away. And so more than likely what that was a result of a warm winter. We didn't get a lot of rain. snow. Instead, we got a lot of rain and a lot of the what firefighters call fine fuels, grasses, shrubs, stuff like that, probably started to green up throughout the state. And then that went ahead and then dried out again, as you can see in the right-hand side of the picture. And that's not a good condition for fire danger. So we went ahead and pivoted it and created this to kind of say, hey, this is why we're seeing some of the conditions that we're seeing today in terms of wildfire danger. The next thing that we did is that that summer and late early fall, we had three very large fires up in Lake County, the Rocky, which is the one that we see there, the Jerusalem, which actually butted up against the tail end of the Rocky on the bottom there. There we go. And then the Valley, which happened just to the left and down to the south. And so we said, okay, can we use satellite imagery in different ways to tell different parts of the story? And so we started playing around with that a little bit more. And then my colleague Mike Corey went a step further and said, okay, can we use this in an investigative way? And this is The Wet Princess of Bel-Air. I don't know how many of you guys have seen this story come out. It came out earlier this week. But basically what Mike did is he used several different satellite imagery techniques to kind of estimate how much water people in Bel-Air were using on their lawns. And it's a really fascinating process. And what we're seeing here is actually he is looking at how much photosynthesis is occurring on the ground. And we'll talk about a little bit about how he created that image here shortly. And then we're not the only ones doing this. ProPublica used satellite imagery to look at land subsidence in Louisiana. They also used it to look at the growth of Las Vegas over the years. I was actually a fellow at ProPublica while they were working on this project, and that's kind of what piqued my interest in working with satellite data. And this was, again, a lot of fun to watch them put together. So how does it work? Traditionally, we see pictures that look like this. This is what most closely approximates what you and I see with our naked eye, right? And it's actually composed of three different images. And each image is captured in a different segment of the spectrum. Thank you. I've been really busy this week. So in this case, it's red, green, and blue. But sensors on satellites are capturing light and wavelengths that we can't see. And this is Landsat 8, which has the red, green, and blue in there. And then a lot of other bands here. We have near-infrared, shortwave infrared, the panchromatic, thermal infrared. And generally what you're going to see here is from left to right, top to bottom, generally is actually the wavelengths are getting longer and light. And so what just happened there? That's odd. Yes. But we can combine these bands in different ways, and that allows us to tell different stories. The first way is we're going to take the near-infrared, the blue, and the green, and we're going to kind of mix them up and put them together in a different way. And what this gives us is what's known as a traditional color infrared image. This was actually developed... This technique was developed in World War II as a way to kind of suss out where camouflaged values were located, because healthy vegetation is going to appear as a vibrant red. I don't know if you can see it in the upper right hand, whereas the less healthy stuff is going to be a darker red. And I think you can see, I'm hoping I'm pointing in the right direction because I have a really weird angle on the screen right now, but that's the Rocky Fire right there. And so this was kind of like what we really wanted to start off our story with when we were talking about the Rocky Fires. Let's take a look at how vegetation was in the area at the time leading up. Now, Landsat images the entire Earth once every 16 days. So this allows us the ability to really get kind of a close time series together. And we were very fortunate that we were actually able to get a decent image actually while the fire was still burning. Then we also played around with, like, okay, let's swap out the bands again and play around with them a little bit more. This time we included the shortwave infrared, the near infrared, and the red, right? That's what I'm reading. Yeah. And what this allows us to do, it actually starts to show a little bit more about burn scars. So we get an idea of where the fire burns. A fire actually does not burn uniformly inside the perimeter. It's more of a mosaic pattern. And so we can start to see that there's little green splotches in here. And we actually rendered this out in 3D to get an idea as to why, what kind of role the topography was playing in this. And these green splotches are all on north-facing downhill slopes. So they're facing away from the sunlight. They're a little bit cooler, and fire does not typically like to spread downhill, so that was also a factor as to why it didn't burn in those areas. But there's more. So images are composed of pixels, but those pixels are more than just, you know, a color. They're actually numbers behind them. And what this allows us, this is actually that same image that we're just looking at. That's one of the bands inside of it. This is the actual values that you see if you open it up in, say, a programming language or something like that. And so, which means that we can do math with them. And this is the formula for NDVI. I don't know how many people are familiar with that, but when I was talking about looking at how much photosynthesis was occurring on the ground, this is the technique that we used. And it's basically an index of sorts that's built off of the relationship between near-infrared and red light. So, and there's a lot of research that went into determining how plants reflect infrared and red light at different stages of its life. And so this is the same scene, the same area. This is an image from 16 days previous to the one that we just saw, and this is the NDVI. If you notice, the color scheme looks kind of similar to the Wet Princess color scheme. It's actually the exact same color scale, everything like that. So Wet Princess, you can see kind of what cultivated vegetation looks like in California, very green, a lot of photosynthesis. This is all uncultivated vegetation. Right here is where the Rocky Fire was. So you can kind of see that the drought really did have an impact here, and vegetation health is not the greatest in these areas. Oh, okay. Yeah, so that's one of the houses that we featured in our Wet Princess. And Mike also did something called a tasseled cap transformation, which, to be quite honest with you, I am not quite sure I grasped entirely. But it is basically, the idea is they process the image in a multitude of different ways, and it yields a series of different results that kind of show you how green the area is, how wet the area is, stuff like that. The bad news is that there's a little bit of a learning curve with this, right? So ideally you would know a little bit about mapping, a little bit about programming, and that's, you know, a lot to tackle right off the first bat. The other problem is that, like, there's also the science behind it, right? The how to put together the satellite imagery, how to, like, represent the data, that sort of thing. Unfortunately, there are tools and resources that help us with this. So most mapping software, ArcView or ArcMap now, I guess it's called, QGIS, they both handle satellite imaging processing, and they do it without you having to know programming, but as I was playing around with those processes and stuff, it's really, really kind of, it's hard to understand what's going on and how to work with the stuff. You can also write your own software using Python or other programming languages. The problem that I found with that was, as I was writing bits of software that was taking, you know, 4 to 6 weeks to actually process an image, you know. And I managed to get that down to 45 minutes, but, like, it still takes some time. It's also, you have to know how to write in a programming language. What we're using now, though, is Google Earth Engine. And Google Earth Engine is free. You do have to apply for access, but it is a hell of a tool. And it strips out a lot of the concerns that we have. I need to scroll down because I can't quite. So let's see. So Google Earth Engine, it has multiple petabytes of data, so millions and millions and millions of gigabytes of data from dozens of different sources. There's Landsat, there's almost all NASA products are in there. There's stuff from the European Space Agency in there. There's, I think, even stuff from Japan in there as well. And it uses cloud computing. So the processes that we were working with that were like killing our computers at work, we can do in seconds here because we will write a script and it'll run in Google Earth, and Google Earth Engine will send that out to, I think they said something like 6,000 to 10,000 different computers, and they will all work in parallel to complete that that image. There's also a very, very strong user community, and these guys are the like kind of nerds among nerds. They are the guys that like work at all the NGOs and the government agencies with this data on a daily basis. They so like I just like to sit and lurk on their listserv, and I learn a ton of stuff about how to do different things. I also get very confused when I read some of their posts, but yes. And it's browser-based, so you don't have to install anything. All you need is an internet connection, and it can be used either Python or JavaScript. Now, I know a lot of people think that they don't have time to learn a programming language. With Google Earth Engine, the JavaScript that you have to know in order to work with it is very, very, very limited, and it's all documented right there on the same page as you're working with it. And this is kind of a sample. This is actually the presentation that I had put together, the imagery that I had put together. Down here is actually the map. Right here is where you write your code. And this is kind of like, you know, where you get results if you want to print something out, that sort of thing. And then on the left, I hope I have the right pane clicked in this image, but this is all the documentation. This lets you, like, so you never really have to leave any this one page, this one area, to really understand how to work with this data. And we had done most of our projects. We've only been working with Google Earth Engine for, like, the last 6 months or something like that. And I thought Jen was going to kill me because we did the same thing in like 15 minutes that took me a year to develop the last time. So I think that's all I have on this. I will say this. There is a huge learning curve with and that is the bad news. And that the good news is that we're all journalists, and like every day we spend it learning something new. And most days it's something very complex and synthesizing it. So I'm fully confident that anybody in this room could pick this sort of thing up. So,
we hit it. Was that one on? Okay. Okay. No, but that one down there. I wonder if that came back.
Hello, 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 hello.
Okay. Okay. So I have lots of questions, but I'm sure we have kind of a big group, so I'd like to open it up to your questions first. We've got about 23 minutes. So what questions do you have? Yeah. And panelists, if you could repeat the question so that everyone on the recording can hear.
Okay, so what's the best way to accelerate the learning curve when working with NASA imagery or with imagery, satellite imagery? So Google Earth Engine's documentation is really good online. They have, again, all the documentation that's right there inside the actual tool. But on top of that, they have an entire website built up around like tutorials and examples and stuff like that. NASA has recently launched a program in the past year or so called the Applied Remote Sensing Education and Training. They love their acronym, so it's RSET. And what that is a series of free webinars typically having to do on a topic such as wildfires or air quality or water. And it has everything to do with what sort of satellite products are out there, what ways there are for processing it. And it's all free and it's online. They do ask that you register, but you can also view archive stuff. I haven't actually looked through it yet. But it is not aimed at remote sensing professionals. It's aimed at policymakers and people like looking to kind of dive into this area. So, and I've talked to the people that have kind of run this program, and they're very interested in seeing more journalists take their classes. So, that might be something to look at.
Yeah.
I'll try. I think for me, the most important thing is I always start by just playing around with the data or just looking at the data set and seeing what are the fields I'm interested in and what kinds of things can I experiment with to see if something happens. When I did my first pipeline story, I downloaded the federal database first just for fun, and then I panicked a bit because there were 200...
Well, time on a Saturday night with pipeline data.
No, it was during work hours. And I panicked a bit because there were 200 columns, and I had never worked with a data set that large. But then I noticed one of the columns was how was the oil spill detected. So I immediately zeroed in on that one, spent a few hours doing some basic analysis. And once I discovered the 5% figure, I immediately knew I had a story. So that's when I went to my editor and said, I think I have a story. You know, can I start taking some more time on this? So I think the most important thing is, don't pitch a story until you've found some basic result in the data, and be aware that as you then report it out, you might end up finding out your initial hypothesis was wrong for some reason because you're missing context. But it's, you know, you have to find the story yourself first and then spend time actually reporting it out. Maybe a couple of days overall.
So I'm going to jump into. So the question, just again, for folks who might not have heard, is how much time do you budget for analyzing the data? Is that accurate? And producing the visualizations and things. And so I have had times when I have spent just a couple of days analyzing data, and I've had times when I have spent months. When I was at the Seattle Times, the investigations editor, I was for a while the deputy investigations editor, somebody would come in and pitch a story to him, and then he would go to a meeting and say, well, it'll take about 2 weeks. And I never worked on a project that took less than 6 months there. So getting an accurate time estimate can be difficult. The way to do that, though, I think, is to know what data you're, you know, as you mentioned, to know what data you're going after. You know, like, is there a metric that would be, that will help you figure out what the story is? You know, what's the shape of your data? In other words, what, you know, what's the boundaries that you want to look at? Because otherwise, what can happen is you can just get lost in that data. Oh, wait, I want to go down that rabbit hole, or look at this. You know, it's like journalists, I don't know if you ever saw the movie Up, but the dogs talk. They have this little radio collar, and every time they see a squirrel, they go, squirrel! And that's kind of like journalists, right? You know, squirrel and story. So you have to kind of go in, at, you know, just like you would prepare for an interview, know what kind of questions you want to ask, you know a little background about the data that you're going to be getting, and then that will help you make sure that you're drilling in and asking the right questions. And not that you can't have serendipity, but you need to kind of monitor that. So the Oso landslide story was a breaking news story. It took us a week to build that map presentation. I worked on it pretty much full time, along with a designer, and so it you know, that took a lot of you know, we could have published it actually in 2 days, but we wanted to make sure that we were really sensitive, so we were very, very careful with how we designed it. If it's a daily story, I could put up a Tableau visualization. I could have it done in an hour. So it really depends. I'm sorry, I can't be more specific.
Okay. Just to build on what she said, I think one of the important things, and we actually, I think, just relearned this lesson recently, is one of the things that's going to save you a lot of time is really take the time to get to know your data. The data is a source, so you have to learn, you know, what it can and can't tell you, what sort of questions that you have to ask of it, that sort of thing. And the best way to do that is find that guy that, like, sits in the back room and works with that data all the time. And nobody ever talks to this guy, so he's going to be more than happy to talk to you. And read any, like, studies or white papers or anything that have to do with how the data was built or that actually analyzes the data. And once you start to get an idea of how you can answer questions, ask questions and get answers out of the data, that's going to give you a better idea as to what sort of time, like, you're going to have to allocate towards working with it.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Hi, I'm Cheryl Pogue with Chemical Engineering News. Eric, I wanted to ask about your background. You seem
Yeah, I think what you're going to find with nearly all of the programmers that are in the on the data side, at least, and probably in the, on the actual application development side, that are journalists, is that they were all probably beat reporters at some point in time. And had taught themselves programming. I was a I started out as a higher education reporter, and I moved through like the typical beats, city government, crime, and all that. And I used my off hours and to learn how to program and do data analysis, and then use that to kind of flesh out my beats as I was covering them.
So the question was whether the landslide had, I said it never, the development never should have built been built in the first place, and the question had to do with why was that, basically. And so there had been multiple landslides over time in that exact same location. And remember, the state had tried to shore up that area again and again, and there had been landslides. A bunch of, you know, some developers went in and bought up all those parcels and started trying to market them and sell them. And there were actually folks who studied the landslides in that area who tried to warn the state that this area should not be developed out. And these reports with the warnings were, you know, just kind of buried. And instead they the approval process for developments just kind of failed, for lack of a better word. I mean, it just did. And what happened was when we started showing like sliders and showing previous landslide, we did like an interactive slider showing like the previous landslide and then the current landslide and things like that. This professor, a former professor from the University of Washington, called us up and said, "Oh, you know, I studied this. I happen to have all the paperwork in my garage. Would you be interested?" And so Ken Armstrong, who was an investigative reporter at the paper, went and spent hours with this guy in his garage and came back with just, you know, stacks of documents showing the lack of adherence to state law. So.
Okay, I was going to make one comment on landslides, too. There is existing data on where landslides have that the USGS has. So even if a landslide has not, come down, they exist. I was at a mapping users group of Silicon Valley meeting, like bonding with other government nerds. And some guy came up and showed me a picture, an ad from our paper, shaking into my face and said, "Do you see this?" And I'm like, "Yeah, it's an ad for a new housing development." He said, "See how the mountain's all wrinkly in the background? Yes. That's a landslide. They're about to build on landslide." So they had all the data of where the landslides are. Then we were able to overlay property records on top of that and show where the houses were being built on top of landslides. So even if they haven't come down, there are existing landslides. Yes. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. In the back, black dress. Yeah. Hard line. And repeat the question, please.
Oh, right. So the question was, what are some just general good federal data sets to look at? I think that the Energy Information Agency just has a ton of information and a ton of data that you can go through on everything related to energy. They're a really good source, and their media spokesperson is great. I forget his name, but if you call him up anytime, he'll return your call and walk you through their website to exactly the data set that you want. Right after the California methane blowout that happened late last year, I got interested in sort of these storage fields, and it turns out the EIA has the only database in the country of where all the existing underground natural gas storage places are. And I think that for other agencies, you know, EPA has a ton of stuff, although it's hard to find their databases online. You probably need to call them up and get some help. Their toxic release inventory database is one of the more helpful ones, although it's pretty complicated too. So I think it's best used if you have a very specific plant in mind or location. Any others?
I'm not good at remembering databases off the top of my head, but NICAR has a list of federal databases that they collect and make available to journalists on a sliding fee scale. So I would suggest going to take a look at what they have and what they collect from the federal government. I'll just echo the EPA database. My students did a story a couple of years ago on a recycling plant in Redwood City where they really wanted to look at the history of problems at this plant. And so they went to get the data from the EPA, and the EPA had the name of the company wrong. They had the company from like its name like 10 or 15 years ago. And we were not confident in some of the other data that they had and how up to date they were. So it's just something, even when you're getting federal data, make sure that what you're getting is up to date and accurate, because it's not always. So
So the question was, how did we use data in the Exxon New project? And actually, we didn't use any data. That was one of those stories that was purely based on documents and interviews. It was very document heavy, and there was no need for, you know, any data. We did some fun visualizations with timelines and infographics, but nothing that required any kind of data analysis.
Can I add something to that? And that is the fact that you use timelines says to me that really you turned your text into data, right? And so really think about any story you do as something where you have some data components, just in how you even track things. When I do a project or a story, I always, even my interviews, I build out into a spreadsheet. I do things with timelines all the time because I might find patterns that I would otherwise miss. So and textual analysis, looking at things, you know, just in unstructured words can be very useful. So
the one other thing I was going to mention is if you don't use it, Document Cloud, which is a free tool for journalists, documentcloud.org. If you don't have an account, you can get one. It's mainly used to process PDFs and make them searchable and make them available to the public if you want to do that, or keep them private if you want that. But it also has some analytic tools in it, like timelines and entity identifier, so it'll show you a list of who it thinks all the people are, who the companies are, and it can be really helpful for that sort of thing as well. It's free.
I also use Document Cloud quite a bit. I have a lot of really complicated studies I read through, and like just being able to like sit there and highlight areas and save that as a note and be able to come back to it. It's also nice because I don't have to carry around like reams of paper with me everywhere I go. The other thing I do is I document everything that I do with my data analysis in a very detailed way. It helps me so much because there are times where I will drop a project for 6 months to a year and then come back and pick it up and have to wonder where I'm at. And I have data diaries that are probably in excess of 100 pages long. Just kind of outlining every single step that I take.
The question was whether we had worked with endangered species data. I have not. I've worked with other kinds of animal data, but not endangered species.
I haven't, but while we were at while I was at ProPublica, we had a freelancer that was basing it off of a book, and I can't remember the name of the book. But they did, ProPublica did do a big project on endangered species. It looks really cool, and it's up online, and it probably has its data sources listed there as well.
I
Okay, well, a couple of suggestions. Oh, sorry. I'm like telling these guys, repeat the question, and I'm not repeating the question. Are there resources to go to for freelance data analysis, visualization, things like that? There are, as somebody who hires people, there's a lot of jobs open right now, too, so it's hard to get people who have a lot of free time. Investigative reporters and editors, they have a data library that does do analysis for news organizations, and it's pretty cost effective. When we're overloaded, I will send stuff to them. They also are like super good about accuracy checking and things like that, so I can feel really good about what they're doing. Also, you know, we, you know, journalism is different now. Lots of organizations partner. So you may want to partner with another organization who has people who can do that. We work with smaller organizations. We have a weekly radio show called Reveal. And oftentimes we work with a smaller organization who wants to do a story for the show, and we kind of all work on the story together. So there are other opportunities like that out there. Lisa, you might actually have some ideas since you are at a smaller organization.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the IRE listserv, the NICAR L listserv, I've seen people post, you know, jobs and project ideas and stuff, so you might use that to advertise for a freelancer. The one time we used a freelance data expert, it happened to be someone my editor had met at a conference who mentioned that he was looking to you know, hoping to help news organizations with data stories, so we got lucky. But I think if you use the NICAR L listserv or even the SEJ one, maybe you might be able to find people.
Any other questions?
Okay, so the question is, how do we know if or how often we get in over our head with data analysis?
Well, so what I mean is, like, when you're analyzing the data, there's variables that you have to consider that you might not know to consider, for instance.
I think
she's saying how to not run with scissors.
Right, basically. So I would say that probably at least once on every project we're in over our heads to some level, you know. I mean, it's just part of the learning curve, right? Every project is going to have it. And so in terms of, like, handling errors and problems in data, I think Jen would probably be the best person to answer this, because she's written about this quite a bit.
I'll add one thing, and that is that I almost always try to find some expert who I can then talk to about what I'm doing to make sure that I'm not screwing up. Just because I'm paranoid. And the night before anything publishes, I'm always awake. And so I want to make that less stressful. And so if I know that I've said, oh, you know what, this is what I did, does that make sense? Am I missing something? That, you know, that really helps me. So
I'll just do real briefly. I mean, there's a lot of tip sheets out there on how to bulletproof your data, but I love that you asked that question, because not enough people do ask how to vet your data and make sure it's right. So one thing we do is, like, add up the data and make sure it matches what might be in a summary report from the same agency. We had a story a couple years ago about pollution pesticide releases in California, and the reporter was adding up the data in the database and also looking at summary reports, and it wasn't adding up. And so she went to the agency and talked to the people who are working with the data and analyzing the data in the agency, not the PIO. And he said, oh, that's the data on the website. That's the bad data. We've got the good data. So he gave her another database that was actually the more current, accurate stuff that they were using to generate their report. So talking to somebody in an agency could be helpful, because often what they have, like, downloadable online isn't necessarily what you should be using. So,
yeah. Go ahead.
So Kat Bagley from Yale Environment 360. Lisa had mentioned the Summer Data Institute.
I mean, I would just say the IRE. Oh, sorry. The question was what are some crash courses you can take to learn basic data skills? I would just say the IRE boot camps. You know, they hold, I think, 3 of them a year on basic Excel and Access stuff. And then they hold other trainings, too, on mapping and statistics. That was how I got into it. I know there are other resources you can use online to just teach yourself, but it's harder to motivate yourself and harder to figure it out when there's no one actually walking you through it.
And the NICAR conference also is a great way to just really kind of get steeped in it. They have a lot of hands-on training sessions throughout the NICAR conference. So.
I think IRE also has stuff up online that you can go through really quick, like a quick Excel tutorial or something like that. So if you can't afford or just don't have the time to make it to one of these boot camps or conferences, because I know everybody's budgets for travel and conferences are really tight. So
they also do, in some limited cases, have some really good fellowship programs. I think they've got some freelancer fellowships and other things, so it's worth looking into.
Oh, I should add one more thing, and that is that at Stanford, we are putting all of our tutorials up online. So if you go to the computational journal, like just the, what is the name of our lab? Anyway, computational journalism lab at Stanford, you'll find a link to a bunch of tutorials. Some of them are by me and some of them are by Dan Nguyen, who used to work at ProPublica and is more like Eric in terms of really knowing a lot of programming. And so he's got some really good tutorials there, too.
Well, first of all, on OSHA data, that is one of the federal databases that IRE makes available. So you might not even have to scrape it. You might be able to just get the data. You can also request the data from OSHA. The last time we got it, though, it came on tape cartridges, which one of which is in our Museum of Outdated Technology. But that is definitely one thing that IRE can help with. Before you scrape a database, I would go to the agency and say, you know, we want the data behind this website. So, which federally they're supposed to do. So,
the other thing about the IRE data is that when they bring in a federal data set, they kind of process it. You know, they clean it. They make sure that, you know, if there are any caveats to be noted, they'll put that in there with the documentation so that you have a better sense of what you're getting and how to analyze it. So.
Scraping is actually like fairly intrusive for an agency. It's basically you're hacking their website. And we do it all the time, and that's fine. I think a lot of times we do it if we don't have time to wait for a FOIA to come through or something like that. But usually the best bet is to always call them and say, hey, listen, can we have this data? And if not, we're gonna hit your servers pretty hard over the next couple of days trying to get them. But like, give them a heads up, and usually that tends to like make them a little more cooperative. So the question is using satellite imagery to look at other environmental aspects. Most of the work that we've done now so far has been usually having something to do with vegetation health, and that's kind of been where we've been focusing most of our stuff. But there are applications for air quality, looking at, I know there's a lot of work being done looking at the smoke plumes from wildfires and stuff like that. Water quality, water storage actually is huge. There are different algorithms out there to look at, you know, how much surface water we actually have, that sort of thing. There's actually a satellite that is able to measure how much water is in the aquifers, which is just crazy to me. And it uses it by sensing how much gravity there is on the planet.
Are you talking about GRACE?
GRACE, yes.
How local can that get?
It's actually got a very bad spatial resolution, so it's you're talking continental scale probably. Yeah. So, in a very least, regional scale, I think it's got a really bad land subsidence. You can also use satellites to determine how much iron content there is in the soil, that sort of thing. So you can do like geological type stuff. Yeah, there's a wide variety, and the sensors are getting better every year. So we're actually able to learn more and more. There's actually one that's just launched within the past couple of years that reads soil moisture. So
I'll just mention, it's a little off topic, but kind of along the same lines. So the satellite photos that we had of the Oso landslide, we got from Esri. And you may know that it rains a lot in Washington. So there was a lot of cloud cover. And so after the mudslide, like every morning, I was on the phone with Esri saying, well, what did we get? And then they called as soon as they saw a decent satellite image of the actual bounds of the landslide, because one of the reasons it took us a week was because we were waiting for a decent satellite image also. So just, I don't know, it's just kind of neither here nor there, but it was one of the challenges. So,
yeah, cloud cover is a big challenge. Actually, the other thing that will happen is our air particulates and stuff will actually diffuse the image, so you get something that looks really fuzzy. One of the ways that we work around that is we actually take, like, maybe there are times where we'll take several years' worth of data or a decade worth of data and average it together and create a composite image out of it. So we'll take, oh, this pixel is covered by a cloud. We'll grab the pixel from the week before and put it there, that sort of thing. And that's a fairly standard process used in satellites, so it's not something that we're kind of making up on the fly.
Yeah, and isn't that what Google Earth Engine does too, to get like the best day for an area and kind of combine them all together?
Yeah, they mosaic them all together. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I put everybody's email up here. We'll be around if you have more questions, but thank you so much. Great group.